May it please the court, counsel, good afternoon. In the 45 years since the United States Supreme Court constitutionalized the right to present a defense, we have come to understand that right to include the right to have a jury properly instructed as to the relevant law and the theory of defense. However, in the state of Colorado for more than 100 years, a defendant who asserts self-defense has enjoyed a constitutional right under the state constitution to have the jury lucidly, accurately, and completely instructed as to the law of self-defense from his perspective. When the trial judge in a self-defense case does not instruct the jury correctly about reasonable belief, he lowers the prosecution's burden of proof, and that is plain error. In this case, the jury was told that Mr. Owens could only use deadly force if he reasonably believed he was about to be the victim of serious bodily injury. Kaufman tells us that is plain error because it lowers the prosecution's burden of proof. In fact, Mr. Owens had just been the victim of bodily injury before he pulled a weapon and fired. When the facts of a case give rise to the issue of retreat, the jury must be instructed that there is no duty to retreat unless you are the initial aggressor. That did not happen in this.
Mr. Franker, kind of back up a minute. I want to make sure I'm tracking. I had, to be honest, a little trouble understanding exactly what in your first argument in your brief, what your argument was. I just wasn't clear what you were suggesting was missing from the self-defense instruction. Is it just that the court didn't instruct on the subsections of the assault statute regarding, the self-defense statute regarding assault? Is that what the issue is? I know you've got apparent necessity, you've got duty to treat and others. On your first argument of your brief, what exactly are you saying was missing?
From the assault portion?
Is that what we're talking about?
Yes.
In the first part?
Okay. The trial court instructed the jury that deadly force could only be used if Mr. Owens reasonably believed he was about to be the victim or someone else was about to be the victim of an offense involving serious bodily injury, and that is legally incorrect under Kaufman. It's plain error. So that is my argument with regard to the assault instruction. There is, however, a secondary argument with regard to the assault instruction, because the way that the jury was referred to even the improper definition of assault that was contained in the instructions was by reference to an instruction that was given to the jury when they considered whether Mr. Owens was guilty of assault in the way that the prosecution presented the case. So the jury had no means of understanding under what circumstances his belief that he was about to become the victim of bodily injury was reasonable.
Pardon me for interrupting, but I'm assuming by your argument that this is plain error, that you agree that this particular issue, the assault issue, was not preserved before the trial court.
I do not agree.
Then, okay.
Defense counsel asked expressly for a proper instruction that tracked the statute on both first-degree assault and second-degree assault, and proposed such an instruction, but did not receive it.
So I guess I'm confused by why you're arguing that that's plain error.
The analysis here is not plain error, but the error is so fundamental that even where it's not preserved, it's plain error under Kaufman. So the no duty to retreat is the next issue that a jury must be informed about, where the facts give rise to that issue. And we know that because Garcia tells us that, and Cassells tells us that, and Nedroga tells us that, and many, many cases tell us that. Here, the defense asked the court four times for an instruction instructing the jury in some way that Mr. Owens had no duty to retreat.
May I interrupt it again,
yes,
please? If I remember correctly, there is also an issue that is attached to this of whether there was evidence in the record to suggest that Mr. Owens was the initial aggressor here. In your comments, if you could please address those two things together.
I will.
Thank you.
Because as you're clearly aware, what the trial court did was to hinge Mr. Owens' right to receive a no-retreat instruction on his acceptance of an initial aggressor instruction. The unrebutted testimony of Jamar Johnson at trial was that Gregory Vann charged Sir Mario Owens, punched him in the face, and made no attempt to retreat. That's the evidence that was before the court. There is no evidence of any kind that Mario Owens was the initial aggressor at Lowry Park. So where the trial court got that from is just frankly unclear. The court apparently made a mistake of law, thinking that by Mr. Owens showing the group of people who were beginning to surround him and Mr. Ray and hem them in that he was armed, that that could be evidence that he was an initial aggressor, but that's legally erroneous. In Colorado, it requires that you strike a blow to be the initial aggressor. Insults won't do it, and an argument won't do it.
But threats will.
There is no evidence in the record that Mr. Owens made a threat.
I understand that, but threats will, correct?
There is no case that holds that.
Indeed, all right.
Can you address on this point, Mr. Franco, while you stop, and I'll give Mr. Kaler a heads up, I'm going to ask him some questions about this too. I'm frankly concerned that the prosecutor appeared to concede there was no basis for initial aggressor instruction, and then the court made findings. Can you address the issue of whether the court was somehow bound by the prosecutor's concession, or is there some way, I'm troubled by this issue. Could you address that? How does the concession fit in?
Well, I would like to tell you that the court is bound by that, but of course the court isn't, because it's the court's job to instruct correctly on all matters of law. However, when the prosecutor tells the court there isn't any evidence that he was the initial aggressor, the court is on notice that both the parties are saying none of our witnesses are going to say that he was the initial aggressor here. And the court appears to have rested its decision to give that instruction after the prosecution, in our view, improperly asked for it, on a theory that he could be the initial aggressor because Robert Ray was obnoxiously drunk and threatening people. But we know from Manzanares that you cannot become the initial aggressor by association. So it appears that the court simply made a mistake of law, which made him believe that it could be possible to give an initial aggressor instruction. But we know that when the court improperly instructs on initial aggressor, that's error, as it is in a self-defense case to improperly instruct on provocation. They're very similar because they can lead the jury to speculate about whether he might have been the initial aggressor. And here there was no evidentiary basis for the jury to possibly conclude that he was the initial aggressor. And the case law holds that if a jury's finding that he was not an initial aggressor would be supported by the evidence, the court must give a no duty to retreat instruction, and that did not happen. So the jury is precluded from considering first that the use of deadly force was reasonable based on his impression that he was about to become the victim of an even more serious assault than the one he just suffered. And in fact, that happened, but it happened after he shot. And the jury was precluded from considering that. The jury was precluded both by the failure of the instructions and by the prosecution's argument from the beginning of the case through the end of their closing that they could have left. And he had no duty to leave, although in fact The evidence appears to support that he attempted to leave repeatedly. He attempted to withdraw from this incipient mob scene, get his friend, and get the heck out of there. But he was prevented from doing so until Mr. Ray shot the men who had imprisoned him and were beating him. And if I may reserve the final 5 minutes.
Of course.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Paul Kaler, 19210 for the people in this case.
Mr. Kaler, obviously, if you would early in your remarks address Judge Gabriel's question concerning the initial aggressor.
Sure. Sorry about that.
And while you're looking for that, Mr. Kaler, let me flesh out my concern and then I'll let you, you can address it in full. And as I understand the record, the government had proposed an initial aggressor instruction. The government said, we withdraw it. The government, at least twice that I can recall in the record, said, I don't think there's any basis for it, or words to that effect. It's not supported. We're withdrawing it. The next day, when the defendant pursued asked for no duty to retreat, the government said, well, I don't think it's complete without initial aggressor. The defense said, you conceded initial aggressor is not in the case. The court then didn't say, I think there's evidence of initial aggressor, at least initially, said, I just am concerned about focusing on one issue or words to that effect. Then the courts, and I don't recall the prosecutor ever arguing that there were facts supporting initial aggressor, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. I don't recall seeing the prosecutor ever saying that. The prosecutor said, well, a reasonable jury could find no initial aggressor, but never argued the opposite. And then the court made these findings. It's very troubling to me, obviously. And you don't really, I don't think you mentioned this at all in your brief, the concession that I can recall. I'm frankly troubled by that. So I really would appreciate your argument and how we can affirm on a finding of initial, that there was a basis for initial aggressor, and you make the argument the facts supported it when everyone conceded there wasn't any basis for it.
Okay, well, hopefully I'll answer your question, Your Honor. First of all, the question here, and my job here, is to defend the actions of the trial court, defend the judgment. And frankly, when I'm in the Supreme Court, I'm here to defend this court's actions, whether I would have agreed with them or not. The question here is, did the trial court make the proper ruling in this issue, giving the defendant this choice? The trial court found that there was evidence to raise a jury issue of who initial aggressor. And I think clearly on this evidence of, with Mr. Ray and Mr. Owens standing there, Mr. Ray saying, in words to the effect, I'm going to kill you all. Both defendants pull up their shirts, showing that they have pistols stuck in their waistbands, and then walk, as you can see on the People's Exhibit 29, I believe, them walking towards the other people. Threat coupled by obvious immediate ability to take into effectuate, in order to effectuate that threat, that is enough to raise a jury question as to whether they were who was the initial aggressors here, or if they were the initial aggressors. I think clearly the trial court had enough evidence before it for it to determine that this was a live issue. I think clearly if you look at Cassell's 92P 3rd 956 right before it turns into 957, it says that non-aggressors who are otherwise entitled to use physical force in self-defense may do so without retreating. Under the statute, under 18.1.704.3b, the question of initial aggressor and standing your ground or no necessity to retreat, those are inextricably intertwined. If there was a jury question here, and as the trial court found that the defendants, Mr. Ray and Mr. Owens, were initial aggressors as to the actual fighting that broke out here, then the trial court was under a duty to instruct the law correctly on this issue of law.
Is the threat enough?
Threat coupled with display of weapons plus threat to kill. And this is not just a heated words argument. This is a threat to kill, a display of weapons, and gesturing and walking towards the crowd. That's enough to create a live issue. And that's all that this court, that's all I believe that the trial court needs in order for this court to affirm that particular ruling is, was this a live issue? And I think clearly the defendant can argue, well, that wasn't a valid threat, I wasn't going to do it, but that becomes a jury question. The question is, in order to give an instruction, or did the trial court give the instruction correctly, was there evidence from which a reasonable fact finder could have found that the defendants were the initial aggressors here?
And your argument, as I, and again, please do correct me, is they were sort of co-initial aggressors? Because it clearly was Ray who made the threat, and then I gather there was some evidence of
they're like peas in the pod, because you can tell from Ray's wife's testimony, it was almost like Ray and Owens were closer in their relationship than she and her husband were. They did everything together. They would die for each other. They would kill for each other. And that's exactly what they did here. They killed for each other, and they killed later on to and threatened and the other things that to only prevent the trial in this particular case. And besides, the trial court gave the defendant a choice after finding that initial aggressor and no retreat are tied together. The trial court gave him a choice. Do you want both of these together, as it is legally proper to do, or do you want to leave it out entirely?
And I don't mean to be monopolizing your time, Mr. Kale, I apologize. Is it your position that initial aggressor always has to be instructed by no duty to retreat, or only when there was some evidence to support it? The defense position, as I understand, is there was no basis for initial aggressors, so they were entitled to no duty to retreat alone. And I just want to make sure, I don't think you're doubting that if there was no evidence of initial aggressor, they would have been entitled to no duty of retreat by itself. Your position is, if you've got some, you got to give them some evidence, you got to give them together. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Besides, the defendant decided he did not want to have these instructions given, and therefore he chose not to have the issue presented to a jury in the jury instructions. And I know that I would say that is a complete waiver of the issue. It takes the strategic reasoning by defense counsel to keep this issue out, both sides, was a binding strategic decision that I guess theoretically could be raised in a 35C as far as ineffective assistance of counsel. I think there was a strong strategic basis for making that, and defense counsel made it. And I think that pretty much prevents review on this particular issue in this court.
But when we to conclude that the court was wrong on initial aggressor, it wouldn't be a waiver, would it? I mean, their position is they had a gun to their head. I mean, they had to make it, that's a terrible analogy in this case, and I don't mean it flippantly. They were compelled, they had to make a choice that was compelled. You can get this instruction you want, condition on an instruction you don't want and don't think is supported. I'm having trouble with saying it's a waiver.
I haven't thought through that part yet.
Okay.
But it's clear there was a strategic basis for this. They didn't want the instruction on initial aggressor coupled with the no duty to retreat.
I appreciate your candor, Mr. Kaler.
I want to say something quickly. Court can go into greater detail if it wants to. Counsel said that there was no bodily instruction issue. I think, my notes show that there was one talking about under second-degree assault with intent to cause bodily injury causes bodily injury by means of a deadly weapon or recklessly causes bodily injury by means of a deadly weapon. I think that's at volume 4, page 811. I think that was just a mistake. I'll talk briefly, I guess, about the prosecution's arguments. I don't think the prosecution ever argued that the defendant was prohibited by law from making these various arguments that he acted in self-defense. I think rather the prosecution was arguing that, in fact, that the defendants were not acting reasonably, and they did not necessarily believe that this was their sole means of doing it. This was not to protect themselves. This was retaliation for being dissed or treated badly by the victims. One thing I noticed preparing for today concerning the multiple assailants jury instruction, the trial court instruction did use the in concert language it used in its instruction. That came from Jones itself, 975 P2nd at 15 through 16. Trial court instructed the jury, in order to defend himself or a third person from what he reasonably believed to be the use or imminent use of unlawful physical force by the other person or those whom he reasonably believed were acting in concert with the other person. I criticized for the trial court a little bit on that, but preparing, I saw that actually is a quotation from Jones. So the trial court was trying to apply the law that the Supreme Court set forth in Jones itself. got so much to say. I don't know where to begin. Does the court have any particular questions I can try and address, other than me sort of fumbling around determining what sounds good to me? Okay.
Well, I've been monopolizing, but in silence from my colleagues, I'll ask you too, that I at least were wondering about. You, in the issue of the excited utterance piece with respect to Mr. Ray, I don't think you responded to their argument that he was, and I'm, and briefs are long, I may have missed it or not remember. I'm not sure you responded to their argument that the facts show he was thinking rationally, therefore it was not an excited utterance. So perhaps you could address that. And then my other question, and then I'll shut up and let you talk.
Okay.
On the probation documents, you've made an argument that the court was correct, that there was no possible relevance, and I'm just wondering how the court could decide without looking at them.
No. I don't think that there was nothing relevant in them. I think the trial court said the defendant had failed to make a specific offer of relevance. It was given a big pile of probation department records. They said, well, we think some of these people who were going to testify, and most of them did not testify, there might be something in there. Our argument is that under the case law, saying there might be something in there is not sufficient to require a trial court to go through voluminous records, especially dumped on it a few days in advance of trial at most. Excited startling event. I think we have a startling event here, shooting of people. Statement was a spontaneous reaction. I think the evidence was that Mr. Ray, he was bent out of shape, they shot people, they went speeding off, they sideswiped a car, they went racing back, they parked in a skewed manner, they went up to the thing, he was screaming or yelling at Mr. Owens, he was crying, he was angry, he punched the glass top table, breaking it with his hand, and his wife testified that she'd only seen him in that state before when their child had died several years earlier. I think clearly that is enough from which a reasonable trial court could have found that he was still under the effect of this highly startling event and was reacting to that. It was not thinking out clearly, thinking out defenses, thinking out how to shift blame and things like that. He was still under the effect of the initial shooting and the excitement of speeding away and stuff. I think, again, the question is not whether other people can say that he was, but the question is whether a reasonable trial court could have looked at this evidence and decided he was still acting under the effect of the shooting and he was still overcome by emotion and he was not rationally thinking through his way through his statement.
Going back to the probation records, I don't recall anything suggesting the prosecutor had failed to follow their obligation to reveal the plea bargains that may have been made relative to those witnesses. Is there anything in the record to suggest that they did not make complete disclosure?
No, Your Honor, I think the prosecution, what I received the record was that the prosecution made complete disclosure of all the large numbers of different resolutions of all the various claims. There are lots of people were involved in all these. I think I counted 20 separate cases involved with this shooting, the destruction of evidence, the witness retaliation stuff. There was a lot of stuff going on. The prosecution did a huge data dump of its deals, of all the other information concerning why these different people had reasons to testify for the government. As the court can look at the cross-examinations the defense team conducted in this case, they brought out lots of things, why reasonable people could find that the various witnesses for both sides should not be believed, and the jury was presented with that and made its credibility determination. I think those are binding, but as far as whether the defense team had enough information with which to defend the defendant, with which to attempt at least to impeach the credibility of the various witnesses for the prosecution, I think that's clearly shown by the record itself, including one of the witnesses here. Another thing that I realized preparing for today, one of the three witnesses who was not mooted out because actually testified was Jeremy Green. He was the one who he was the alleged victim in the counts concerning attempted murder. He was the one that got up and that people said, I can't remember if it was Mr. Ray or Mr. Owens, pointed a gun at him and tried shooting him, and his gun didn't fire. The prosecution charged Mr. Owens with attempted murder for that, and the and Mr. Green, when he got up and testified, he said, "I don't remember anything about what had happened." And as a result, the jury acquitted Mr. Owens of that of the offenses concerning that particular action. So I think Mr. Green, the claim concerning Mr. Green is moot as well, as far as all the other mootedness reasons I gave for the court for the various other parts of the claim. I only have 14 seconds. I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Back just over 50 seconds.
Thank you. With regard to the hearsay statements that came in as excited utterances, I know the court's aware of this, but the test is whether Mr. Ray's thought processes were operative. And you don't get to have an excited utterance just because you're drunk. And that's essentially what we have here. We have a very drunk man, by all the evidence from the witnesses at trial, who has just shot two people, screaming and yelling and breaking tables. But he was also engaged in reflective thought during the time between Lowry Park and the time that he made these statements. And that analysis is, we're happy to rest on our briefs as far as the operative thought process analysis, but it's important to remember that this was a drunk man. So the view of whether he was upset as a result of what he had just done is skewed by that. Where the excited utterances error becomes so profoundly important is that, given the instructional problems with this case, where the jury was precluded from considering much of what it needed to consider on the issue of self-defense, the way these statements were used was that they were brought in through LaToya Ray as evidence that Mr. Owens's actions were absolutely unreasonable, and as evidence that other people at Lowry Park weren't armed. There was no basis for that, and the defense was entirely unable to test those statements. So the combination of the instructional errors and the confrontation violation collide to create a situation in which the jury is not capable of correctly considering what it needed to consider in order to determine whether he properly acted in self-defense.
Pardon me, Mr. Our standard of review on this issue is abuse of discretion, correct?
On the confrontation violation?
No, the hearsay issue.
On an evidentiary error it is, but here I would...
I understand the constitutional issue, but on the evidentiary issue, it's abuse of discretion, correct?
Yes, but if it's a confrontation violation, it's constitutional harmless error. And clearly, there's a confrontation issue at least lurking about here. If his statements were not properly excited utterances, and we believe that the evidence shows that they were not, then to allow them to come in before the jury is clearly a confrontation violation and is subject to constitutional harmless error. With regard to the parole department and probation department records, Mr. Kaler states that it was reasonable for the trial court to withhold this information because it received it such a short time before trial. But when we look at the right to present a defense, inherent in that right is the right to discover all favorable evidence. And if the trial court didn't receive those materials in time to do a correct in-camera analysis and provide them to the defense, that wasn't the defense's fault. It was the government's fault. And I don't mean necessarily the prosecution, but the Department of Corrections and the probation office, which is an arm of the court. The defendant's right to discover all favorable evidence doesn't take a back seat to the closeness of trial, because the defense was not dilatory in attempting to obtain those records.
In your limited time, Mr. Franco, could you respond to Mr. Kaler's argument? I know I'm harping on this initial aggressor thing. Obviously, I'm concerned about it. Mr. Kaler says there was evidence of initial aggressor. Robert Ray said, "I'm going to kill you." They both lifted up their you know, shirts or whatever to show the guns. Why isn't that sufficient evidence of initial aggressor?
Well, the government claimed that in its brief as well. And in our reply, we pointed out that that was the argument of the senior prosecutor in his opening statement, and it was absolutely unsupported by the evidence trial. No witness ever said that Robert Ray, in the hours he spent there before Sir Mario Owens came there to try to extract him, was rolling around threatening to kill people. No witness supports that. That is not evidence in the record. The only evidence in the record was that Mr. Owens and Mr. Ray showed this incipient mob that they were armed in what has been considered in other cases where a weapon was shown, an attempt to remove themselves from the situation, to make clear to the would-be assailants that they didn't want to mix it up and should be simply allowed to depart. And that's what the evidence shows was happening in this case. There's no evidence that there was any verbal altercation between Mr. Owens and Mr. Van before he was struck by him. Mr. Van made a threat, but there is no evidence from any witness that Mr. Owens made a threat. And I see I'm out.
Yes, you're out of time. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Okay, the arguments on this case are concluded. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Counsel, thank you for your arguments today. Please drive safely home.